the fighting in Gaza and protests all over Palestine against Israel, it's become clear that this now is seen by Arabs and almost all of the people across the global south as the last anti-colonial struggle. Israel is the last remnant of 19th century European white settler racist colonialism. They came, they pushed out the Palestinians, who had 93% of the population of Palestine, and they created an Israeli state. They succeeded, but they only succeeded because they had tremendous support from the white racist colonial British, and now they have it from the Americans. So the colonial nature of this process, and it's still going on, they're still in the West Bank. Gangs of settlers are going around burning Palestinian villages. They've expelled 500 people from their villages in the last month or two. And they're still doing settler colonial expansion and driving out indigenous people. This is now the driving force for the resistance against Israel and against the United States and Europeans who joined them. This is the last anti-colonial struggle in the world. And that's why you see huge demonstrations all over the world when things like this happen. You know, there's basically four global forces now that attract significant human political support across the entire world. And they're climate change, Me Too, gender equality, Black Lives Matter, which is anti-racism, and Palestine. And Palestine is a global issue, and the Americans and the Israelis and most of the Europeans and now the Canadians to a large extent are too blinded to see this reality. So they feel that we can send in more military force, be tough on TV, and it'll work, but it doesn't work. And so there's really time for a reassessment. And the Americans, of course, learned this in Vietnam, they learned in Afghanistan, they learned it in Iraq, but they haven't learned it. And the Israelis haven't learned from their experiences either. So resistance and defiance keep driving people in the Arab countries and elsewhere to push back against what the Israelis are doing. And we're not saying get rid of all the Israelis or kill them. We're saying let's have a negotiated peace where there's an Israeli state that's predominantly Jewish like it is now with a Palestinian state where the refugeehood and exile of the Palestinians has been resolved according to international law, and we have our sovereign state, and we live in peace. We've made this offer. The Arabs have made this offer repeatedly to Israel, but it's not interested in that because Zionism is a strategy, is an ideology that wants to create a Jewish state in a land that was 93% Arab, and it succeeded, and it doesn't want peace with the Palestinians. It wants all the Palestinian land, and they want it exclusively for the Jewish people. You know, the world supported the creation of an Israeli state, and after the Holocaust, that was understandable. And not just the Holocaust, it was a century or more of white European, North American racism and anti-Semitism against Jews. The Jews were terribly mistreated by white racists in Europe and North America. And they came to the Middle East because they knew that they had always lived there. They were accepted in society as an integrated part of society. And the early settlers who came in the late 19th century and early 20th century up until around 1920, the Jews who came were very accepted in the region. There was no problem. They'd always lived there until it became clear in the around 1930 that they wanted to create a state. They wanted to take over and drive out Palestinian Arabs and have a Jewish state. And this coincided with the rise of the Nazis in Europe, which significantly increased the migration of Jews out of Europe. And, of course, the United States and Britain refused to take them, refused to let the Jews come in. So you have multiple dimensions of historical responsibility. But the final point is that we're at a stage now where we and the world increasingly clearly see this as an anti-colonial struggle aiming for a just peace, equal rights for an Israeli state and a Palestinian state and the other Arab countries whose lands have been ravaged or annexed or occupied by Israel. The Israelis are not interested in that. The Americans totally are uninterested in that. And so this is a real dilemma. What the world needs to study more than, you know, what are Hezbollah's motives is what is the nature of North American, European, white, racist colonialism, because it's still going on.
I wanted to go to something that just happened before the broadcast, and that is one of the hostages who was released speaking. Hamas has released two Israeli civilians held hostage in Gaza. On Monday, a Hamas spokesperson said 79-year-old Nurit Cooper and 85-year-old Yocheved Lifshitz had been let go for humanitarian reasons. Hamas shared video showing armed fighters releasing the elderly hostages to Red Cross officials just before the video ends. Yocheved Lifshitz reaches back to shake the hand of one of her captors, saying shalom, the Hebrew word for peace. Earlier today, Yocheved Lifshitz spoke to reporters in Tel Aviv. She describes the scene where she was kidnapped. She was very critical of the Israeli government, saying that the Hamas had released fire balloons, as she described it, that the fields were burning for weeks before. She was taken on a motorbike with two Hamas fighters, then walked for miles through what she called a kind of spider web of underground tunnels. Once in Gaza, Yocheved Lifshitz says her treatment improved. Her daughter, Sharon, who flew in from London for her release, translated her remarks to reporters.
My mom is talking about coming there. When they arrived into a large hall in which about 25 hostages were gathered. And after two or three hours, those hostages, five of them, she among them, were taken into a separate room. My mom is saying that they were very friendly towards them and that they took care of them, that they were given the medicine. They were given medicine and they were treated. One of the men with them had a badly injured from a motorbike accident on the way, and the paramedic was looking after his wounds. He was given medicine and antibiotics. That the people were friendly, that they kept the place very clean.
We were very hurt by the fact that the IDF did not know. Where are the scapegoats?
They've
warned us 3 weeks prior with people who came to the road and burned fields, sent incendiary balloons to burn our fields, and the IDF did not address this seriously. Suddenly, on Saturday morning, when everything was quiet, there was a heavy bombardment of the communities. And with that, the masses infiltrated, blew up the expensive fence. Opened the gates of the kibbutz and entered in their masses. It was extremely difficult. I keep having those images in my mind. He's asking, why did you shake the hand of the Hamas terrorist in the visual? They were gentle with us. Our needs were supplied.
אמא שלי אומרת שהם התייחסו אליהם בעדינות וסיפקו את כל הצרכים שלהם. My mom is saying that they treat them kindly and provided for them.
That was 85-year-old Yocheved Lifshitz being translated by her daughter, Sharon. Yocheved's husband, Oded, is still a hostage. Last week, the legendary Israeli journalist Amira Haas talked about Oded Lifshitz on Democracy Now!
I have no idea how many people... How many of the hostages? Some of them I know their relatives. I know one of them who is 85 years old and a very brave journalist who in Oded Lifshitz, his name, I just realized it. He's 85. He was in the 70s. He exposed the expulsion of Bedouins in the northern of Sinai. He exposed it in a series of articles. I know some people that are relatives of, as I said, of friends of mine.
So that's Amir Haas, the legendary Israeli journalist, talking about Oded Lifshitz. He is still a hostage. His wife, as you can see, Yocheved Lifshitz, was just released. Rami Khoury, I was watching CNN earlier this morning just as this press conference was happening, and the response right out of it, it was the host, Aaron Burnett, who is in Israel right now, said clearly she's voicing Hamas talking points. And when Yocheved said that the doctors came every 2 or 3 days and gave them medicine, and if they didn't have the proper medicine, they would get some kind of replacement medicine, she said that proves that Hamas is hoarding medicine because the Palestinians don't have it. Your response to Yocheved Lifshitz, what she said, she is a peace activist in Israel who is one of the hostages just released.
Well, my response to her, but also to you, is first, don't watch CNN in the morning if you want news about the Middle East. That's bad for your health, it's bad for your mind, and it's bad for your intake of serious, accurate news and analysis. There are many other, much better sources around the world. Mainstream American TV is a catastrophe in this respect. My reaction to Yehuda, I think her name is. She represents two things to me, and I've spent my whole life in the U.S. and around the world interacting with very, very close Jewish friends who I've known all my life, and people in the Arab world and Europe and everywhere. And my reaction is that she represents probably the essence, I think, of what makes Judaism such a special religion. It's based on ethics, it's based on love, it's based on truth, it's based on respect for God, and it's based on the quest, as God told Moses, to tell the Jews, to tell the world. It's based on the pursuit of justice. Seek justice and only justice, Moses said. So she, that all echoes in what she said. She was honest. She was friendly. She said the truth, we assume. I don't think she was, orchestrated or taught to say any of these things. The fight that Hamas has, that we all have, is not with Jewish people. It's with the Zionist movement, which became the State of Israel, which is widely recognized around the world as an apartheid system. The second thing I recognize about her comments is how the Israeli defense system in the south completely collapsed, was totally incompetent. And those towns, those settlements, the kibbutzim in the south, are mostly located on the ruins of Palestinian villages that were destroyed in 1947-48. There was about 500 Palestinian villages that the Jewish fighters, before the declaration of the State of Israel, from late 1947 to May 48, you had militant Jewish groups carrying out terrorism, pogroms, acts of great violence to get the Palestinians out, and they succeeded. About 750,000 Palestinians were driven out of Palestine before the declaration of statehood on May 15, 1948, Israeli statehood. And there was 500 villages, and they were destroyed, and people left, and many of them were where those kibbutzim are in the south. So I think that's another factor that we have to take into consideration, and it raises the question of, where do you make a distinction between ordinary Israelis, people in the reserve forces, people in the active military? The problem is our battle is with the Zionist movement and Israel, which has done what it has done to us, and we're resisting and fighting back. But even in the heat of battle, you get human, decency shown by both sides, because we are both humans and we are decent, but we are also in a state of active, violent warfare that's been going on for almost a century. About a century. Because really, the fighting in Palestine between Jews and Palestinians started around the late 1920s, is when 1929 was the big first clashes in Palestine. And ever since, so it's been almost a century that this war has been going on. So you can't analyze any of this stuff in isolation. You have to look at the deeper context. And at the same time, don't lose sight of the humanity of both the Jewish people and the Palestinian people.
Rami Khoury, want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian-American journalist, columnist with 50 years' experience in the Middle East, senior policy, public policy fellow at American University in Beirut. We'll link to your article in Al Jazeera. Believe it or not, justice will prevail in Palestine. Next up, we look at Israel's endgame. Is it to push Palestinians into Egypt? Back in 20 seconds. Performed by El Fanoun, a Palestinian popular dance troupe. This is Democracy Now! I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Health officials in Gaza say Israel's unrelenting bombardment of the besieged Palestinian territory has killed another 700 people over the past 24 hours, bringing the death toll over the past 18 days to more than 5,800 Palestinians. Among them, 2,000 children are dead. 1.4 million Gazans, more than half of the territory's population, has been displaced. Many say there's no safe place to be in Gaza right now. The World Health Organization's pleading for far more aid to be allowed into Gaza through the Rafah border crossing with Egypt. We're going to look now at Egypt's response to Israel's bombardment of Gaza and the negotiations over aid coming through Rafah. We're joined by Sherif Abdelkadous, independent journalist working with the Egyptian news outlet Matamasser. He won a George Polk Award for his Al Jazeera documentary, The Killing of Shireen Abu Akla. His latest piece for The Guardian is headlined, Israel's Endgame is to Push Palestinians into Egypt and the West is Cheering On. Sherif, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about all that's taking place right now around the Rafah border crossing and explain who it's controlled by and explain what Israel is calling on Egypt to do?
Thank you, Amy. I think, well, first of all, we have to understand Egypt is the only country other than Israel to share a border crossing with Gaza. And what we've seen since October 7th is a lot of negotiations around what's going to happen at this border crossing. So as it stands right now, Egypt has insisted on allowing humanitarian aid into Gaza and has allowed multiple countries to deliver aid to Arish in northern Sinai. Countries like Jordan, Turkey, Qatar, the UAE have delivered thousands of tons of humanitarian aid that are kind of idling in these trucks at the border. So far, since Saturday, something like 75 or 80 trucks have been allowed in, about 20 trucks a day after a lot of negotiations. 20 trucks a day are being allowed in by Israel into Gaza. And this is nowhere near enough. You know, according to humanitarian organizations, they've called it a drop in the ocean. And just to give you a sense, 20 trucks a day amounts to about 4% of an average day's imports before October 7th, before 1.4 million people were displaced, before 15,000 people were injured, before, close to 6,000 people were killed. So, the UN is saying that hundreds of trucks a day are needed. And on top of that, Israel has placed heavy restrictions on that, even that minuscule aid that's coming in. Well, firstly, Israel has bombed the Gaza side of the Rafah border crossing four times since October 7th, even one time slamming into Egyptian territory at the border. But the aid, when it comes in, it travels to the Auga-Netzana border crossing with Israel, where it's first inspected by Israeli authorities. and then it eventually gets into, goes back to the Rafah border crossing and goes into Gaza. This is a process that takes many hours. But I think we have to understand that there's two issues that really stand out on the restrictions. First of all deliveries of aid to northern Gaza are prohibited. So none of this minuscule, even this like paltry amount of aid is getting to northern Gaza. You know, hundreds of thousands have evacuated from northern Gaza after Israel warned people to leave. But there's still hundreds of thousands that remain. And just to give you a sense, the biggest hospital in Gaza is in Gaza City, Shifa Hospital. This is a hospital that usually in normal times has a capacity of about 700 patients. It's currently overwhelmed with 5,000 patients. And you have something like 45,000 displaced people gathered in and around the hospital grounds seeking shelter. That's according to the UN. And none of the aid that's coming in is getting to them. But secondly, and very importantly, the aid that is coming in, none of it includes any fuel. Fuel is not being allowed to enter. And fuel is just absolutely crucial for so many things, perhaps most importantly for electricity, to run generators. And without fuel, life-saving medical equipment like incubators, ventilators won't work. And so this spells a death sentence for babies in neonatal wards and things like this. So one official has called it, you know, that the aid coming in is more of a diplomatic symbol rather than actual meeting any humanitarian needs. But we have to see where this is going.
And Sharif, I wanted to ask you, first of all, on the water situation, could you, is all water still cut off by the Israelis? And secondly, isn't the whole issue of Israel urging people to leave Gaza through Egypt a clear sample of ethnic cleansing after all? Israel has many many entrances on its side of the Gaza Strip where it could allow women and children to come out of northern Gaza, possibly even bus them into the West Bank. But they're clearly trying to get rid of the Palestinians, as many as possible, from their occupied territories.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I mean, first of all, an issue of water. And people have talked about there's a real risk of dehydration to death. People are drinking now dirty water. The aid that's coming in is not enough. You know, the first day it provided water for about 22,000 people for a few hours. And we're talking about a place which has 2.3 million people, and no water has been allowed in since October 7th. No aid at all has been allowed in, except for these small convoys. There has been a water pipeline that was that is supposedly working near Khan Yunis, but it's not nearly providing enough. And yes, this idea of... So first of all, this order comes down from Israel. Well, first of all, Netanyahu, when this all began on October 7th, took to the airwaves announcing a war against Hamas and telling people in Gaza to leave now, you know, and saying, you know, he left unsaid where they're supposed to go. But then there was this order to evacuate to the south. 1.1 million people are supposed to evacuate within 24 hours. And you see this kind of push towards the Egyptian border. And from what we understand, reporting through Madame Asr, that Egyptian sources have told us that in those days, in the beginning at least, there was a lot of pressure and continuing for Egypt to open the Rafah border crossing to create a so-called humanitarian corridor and to allow for the forcible displacement of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from Gaza into northern Sinai. And that instead of the United States and other Western countries pressuring Israel for a ceasefire, pressuring Israel to create, to allow in the necessary amount of aid, they have instead been pressuring Egypt to open the border and allow for this mass displacement and have been offering economic incentives to Egypt to do so. We have to remember Egypt is undergoing a very severe economic crisis with a massive amount of debt, with record high inflation. And so, you know, there's been talk of debt relief, of financial compensation in order to allow for this kind of displacement. Now, Egypt's response has been kind of very staunch on this, actually. The president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has very publicly rejected this idea of having a form of ethnic cleansing and a forced displacement and exile into Sinai. He has cited Egypt's sovereignty in this. He has cited the Palestinian cause in all of this. He has even, you know, is drumming up and is riding a wave of public support for this because, you know, this is the Palestine, as we heard from Rami Khoury, is a touchstone issue for so many across the Arab world, for so many across the global south. And this idea of what they call a second Nakba, a second catastrophe and a second mass displacement, is firmly rejected. So even Sisi called for protests on Friday for people to take to the streets. And people did in Cairo and Alexandria and other places. Although some people, you know, carried on those protests into Tahrir. Some were chanting revolutionary chants. And we haven't seen that for many years. And actually, Egyptian authorities have arrested over 100 people because of that. But, you know, I think many see Sisi's stance as laudable, rejecting what is essentially an endorsement of a second Nakba. But I think we have to remember that, you know, him citing the Palestinian cause really rings hollow. And we have to remember that Egypt, its concerns really are national security concerns, not wanting to have a mass population of Palestinians who could, you know, launch attacks against Israel from northern Sinai and not having to deal with the refugee crisis. Egypt, after all, has helped enforce the siege on Gaza for many years. It destroyed the tunnels that provided a lifeline to Gaza. It has allied with Israel in many different ways in security coordination. It has allowed Israel to conduct a covert air campaign, aerial bombing campaign in Sinai. And it also treats Palestinians coming in and out of Gaza notoriously with indignity. But so far, this idea of rejecting this kind of mass exodus, I think a lot of people are supportive of that policy, and instead trying to pressure Israel to allow humanitarian aid in.
Ultimately, Sharif, is it Israel, is it Hamas, is it Egypt, who is preventing that aid? As you said, we're seeing dozens of trucks now after weeks of not having anything, when in fact they're talking about the need is something like 400 to 500 trucks a day. And also when it comes to what happened this weekend in Cairo, the so-called peace summit of Arab leaders, what did they come up with?
Well, the peace summit didn't actually come up with anything. There wasn't a joint statement that was signed. Sisi and King Abdullah and others repeated condemnations of Israel's bombing, of Israel's siege on Gaza. And Sisi again rejected this idea of a mass displacement to Sinai. And I think, you know, we have to also understand that this idea of resettling Palestinians in Gaza to Sinai is not a new one. It's actually an old colonial fantasy. There has been numerous plans by Israel and others of this idea of resettling the Palestinians in Gaza, who 80% of which are refugees, by the way, who are refugees from 1948, of resettling them again into Egypt. In the mid-1950s, the UN devised a plan for this kind of mass resettlement, and it was met with a popular outrage in Gaza and kind
we
of
have 15
crushed
seconds.
In a popular uprising. So, I mean, these kinds of plans are longstanding, and there's a real fear that they will be realized. But for now, we have to see Egypt is rejecting it, but Israel's creating a situation where life is becoming unlivable in Gaza.
Sharif Abdelkaddous, independent journalist working with the Egyptian news outlet Matamasser, produced the award-winning documentary The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh about the Palestinian-American journalist. We will link to your piece in The Guardian. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep you informed, we also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.